your minds for a new scale of physical scientific values, gentlemen.
To a new world of gods and monsters.
The atmosphere has become so polluted with deadly germs that it can no longer be breathed.
Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 118. This time around we're looking at slimy monsters and the first of a resurrected kind of horror film from England in the 1960s. The first movie I'm talking about is The H-Man, directed by Ishiro Honda, who also directed Godzilla and a number of other kaiju movies. He's the John Ford of Japanese horror movies. And then we move on to a portmanteau film from 1965, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, starring Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and a bunch of other kind of interesting character actors. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of our way, and we can start talking about horrible movies in the best sense of the word.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest as genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school.
Okay, so how's everyone been? If you're in Texas and Florida, I'm sorry for the question, and I hope that everything is fine for you. I'm sure I do have some listeners in Florida or Texas, apart from Dave Mack. So look after yourselves, do what you have to do, and be kind to each other. So yeah, been an interesting week or so. With Sally does craft, and she does some kind of very transgressive jewelry at times. And so we went to the Fetish Expo here in Melbourne on Saturday, and sold her stuff at a stall for about 7 hours. And it was really interesting. There were people dressed up as anthropomorphic animals. There was a lot of latex. There was a lot of women in very, very, very little clothing. And a lot of people getting spanked and whipped and all sorts of other bits and pieces, which never fazes me, that kind of thing. As long as everything's consensual, it's fun. And we've got some friends who are in that lifestyle, so we got an opportunity to sell some of Sal's stuff, and she designed some things specifically for that. And it was a good day. She did well with the selling, and it was kind of fun. And the lovely thing was that the people running the show came around and sold food to the people on the table, so we ended up with a very nice paella and a few other bits and pieces. And the vibe there was very, very fun. There was only one thing that really confronted me and confronted my sensibilities at all. There was a woman there, and this is, again, as I said, consensual, a woman there with her lips sewn up with thick black thread. That was a little bit confronting to see. But again, it's consensual, and obviously there was a meaning there for her. And it was her pushing her limits within her own boundaries, so that's perfectly fine. The other thing that's happening in my world is, apart from the retirement thing, which is I'm still kind of working my way through, is there's a same-sex survey that the government's put out. So we've got a conservative government, which is totally fucked in the worst possible ways. And so they've decided they're going to put a survey out to everybody in Australia, but you don't have to vote for it. It's non-compulsory. Saying, do you think that the law should be changed to enable people of the same gender to marry? So a bit of marriage equality there. So there's a yes-no survey. They send it out by mail, and there are problems because people are selling their ones online. Some people are stealing mail. Some posties are just leaving the mail on top of mailboxes so other people can steal it. So there are all these issues with it. But it's the only way in the short-term future Australia is going to get marriage equality. So Sally and I got our surveys today and mailed them off within an hour in a post office box. In a post box. And because we support marriage equality, I think it's fair. I think it's reasonable. I think giving people the same rights as straight people in society is a good thing. The Conservatives are putting up some really strange arguments about that around here. The weirdest of them is it's an infringement on their religious freedom, because people would be discriminated against for not marrying gay and lesbian couples, and not they'll be sued if they don't make wedding cakes, and all this kind of bullshit's coming in there. And they're also running a line about children should be raised by a mother and a father. Now, that doesn't happen in straight couples when people divorce, but they don't seem to be taking that as an issue. So the survey is actually about, do you agree that people, same-sex people, should be able to marry? It's not about anything else. That's a yes-no answer. But the Conservatives are really kind of running all of these extraneous issues, which aren't what the survey is about. And we have in place a number of laws to protect people's, unfortunately, to protect people's rights to discriminate. And so the Conservatives are running with the only arguments they've got that are valid. Some idiot crowdfunded a skywriting thing saying vote no over Sydney yesterday, which was kind of weird. And the culture wars are hotting up here somewhat. And that makes for interesting times. Our table had a marriage equality banner on it, which was something that was offered to us, and we accepted because we wanted to show that not only Sally's business, which is called Tiddles Emporium, if you want to look it up on Facebook, it's got a page, and it's also got an Etsy page. So we put that up there because we believed in it. We got married 11 years ago. At our marriage ceremony, we talked about the fact that we wanted marriage equality 11 years ago, and it's still not happening in this country. So, interesting times we live in. Between that and going to the Kink Fest, where everybody was really nice, the amount of really nice people we met there. There was a guy called Tom, who's a graphic designer, running the table next to us, who designs T-shirts and cards and stickers and things, and he was quite nice. He came over from Adelaide. Just everybody else we met were fine. I knew a few people already, so I said hi to a few people I knew. And, basically, this podcast is about inclusion, and this podcast is also about the rights for people who are same-sex attracted to have the same rights as any other people in this country, and in fact in the world. So leaving that aside, that politics came up unexpectedly. I wasn't expecting that. So what have I been watching? Let's get on to something that's a bit neutral here. I did pick up a copy. I did a YouTube video. You might want to check out the YouTube page. About non-European vampires in movies. And one of the movies I referenced was The Jitters. It's an American film, but it has Jongshu in it, which are Japanese hopping vampires, which are a bit of an obsession with me at the moment. I actually picked up a Funko Pop vinyl figure of a Chinese hopping vampire the other day, and Sal's buying me a couple of other ones. There are a few in the set. And The Jitters is an American movie from 1985, which is kind of low budget and slightly amateurish, but it was the first American movie to really feature Chinese hopping vampires, which there are a number of different pronunciations, but the one I'm going with is Jongshu. It was a bit of fun revisiting it. The quality of the DVD I got isn't great because it came from a VHS master. But nonetheless, it was fun revisiting one of those kind of VHS-era horror movies, which were all over the video shops here in Australia at the time. I think Roadshow released it here in Australia, and it was in video shops for a decade or more and was quite popular in that. So I watched that. The other thing I watched was one of my anime obsessions is Yu-Gi-Oh! So I watched Yu-Gi-Oh! The Dark Side of Darkness, which is a new movie extending the classic Yu-Gi-Oh! Story. If you're not into Yu-Gi-Oh!, it's no big deal. But I liked it and I had a bit of fun with it. I picked it up fairly cheaply at JB Hi-Fi, and it's one of my anime things. And so I enjoyed that. Now, for the radio gig, Liz Travascus, my old pal with whom I used to do the radio gig at ABC Radio in the Northern Territory, was back for a week looking after the store while Rebecca McLaren was on a bit of leave. Liz sitting in on the gig came up on very short notice. So she said, the only thing I've seen is the TV version of Dirty Dancing, which was done as a three-hour special on American TV and appeared on Australian TV not too long after. Do you want to do that, or do you want to try to think of something else to talk about? So I bit the bullet and said we were going to do the 2017 TV iteration of Dirty Dancing. Now, I had a few problems with it. First one was I didn't like Dirty Dancing, the original. I think Patrick Swayze looks fucking creepy. But I muscled through, and it was bad. It was seriously, deeply Tommy Wiseau bad. They turned it all into a musical. Oddly enough, it had a good Australian director, Wayne Blair, an Indigenous Australian director, who directed a good movie called The Sapphires, if you want to check that out, because the Dirty Dancing remake is not his best work. So we kind of worked through that and eviscerated that and talked about other remakes that didn't work. So we kind of extended it to the half an hour and just had a bit of fun with that. Now we're back again with Rebecca next time I do this in a week's time. But it's her last gig before she goes on maternity leave. So I don't know with whom I'm going to be doing the ABC radio gig in future. I'm sure they're going to be lovely because I got on with everybody I've worked with on that, with a tiny exception, which is kind of a glitch, but it occasionally happens. Nonetheless, it was fun to do, but not fun to watch. It was a real ordeal to watch that 3 hours of Dirty Dancing. It wasn't done well. The song choices in the songs that they used to turn it into a musical was the obvious stuff, and the anachronisms, because it was set in 1963, the anachronisms were replete all across the board. Just didn't work at all. Abigail Breslin, who's played Baby in it and who is a fine young actor, can't dance. She didn't know how to dance before she took on Dirty Dancing, which is, you can see a problem there. You can see where things may go wrong. And indeed they did. It was very, very awkward. And she's young enough that her career will bounce back from that, but it's going to take some serious work for that to occur, which is a little bit sad. So I watched that. And the only other thing I watched, I tried to watch, right about three quarters of the way through and was bored fuckless, was a young adult attempt to, well, a young adult-oriented attempt to start a superhero franchise. It's a movie called Max Steel. Now, I watched the Max Steel cartoons, I think in the 90s, maybe in the early millennial times. They were computer-generated animation. They were a bit of fun. They were kind of dynamic and worked. But as a live-action one, it was a fucking drag. There was nothing new, nothing interesting, nothing charismatic, no actors that stood out at all. It was boring as fuck, so don't even bother trying. So that was about all that I've watched. I watched a lot of TV, I watched a lot of YouTube videos, but nothing kind of worth mentioning at the moment. So I'm going to take a break. And when I get back, we're going to talk about The H-Man, directed by Ishiro Honda from 1958.
Of a great city to the last desperate refuge of millions underground, the incredible, monstrous H-Man strikes terror to every heart, disintegrates everyone it touches. It kills but can't be killed. The most incredible man you never saw. Deadly byproduct of the H-bomb blasts, dooming mankind to oblivion.
We are facing a situation which cannot be minimized. Complete extermination.
Did you start yet?
Yes.
Masada went into the sewer.
Where?
Right there.
a great city, fight back.
Commence operations.
To stop the deadliest killer the world has yet encountered.
Ishiro Honda's 1958 horror film, The Age Man, has a much better title in Japanese. In Japanese, the title translates as The Beauty and the Liquid People, which I kind of like. I really enjoy that. It's a very atypical movie in Honda's oeuvre. He was mostly known for his kaiju stuff and much more large-scale monsters. But the liquid monsters, which bear a little bit of a resemblance to the blob that attacks Steve McQueen in this very same year that this one came out. So I don't think one movie was copying the other. I think it's just one of those coincidences of timing where the two movies on roughly the same subject came out in two separate countries approximately the same time. The plot for this one's fairly simple. I'll just read the summary from IMDb. When a narcotics deal goes sour and a suspect disappears, leaving only his clothing, Tokyo police question his wife and stake out the nightclub where she works. His disappearance stumps the police until a young scientist appears who claims that the H-bomb tests in the Pacific, evidenced by a ghost ship that has turned up in the harbour, have created radioactive creatures, H-men, who ooze like slime and dissolve anyone they touch. I'm having trouble with words today, but that's basically it. The Japanese version of this movie, I had the English language version, which was dubbed, and it's got all the problems you have from a Japanese film of a certain time that was dubbed into English, in that the English voice actors all try to do Japanese accents, including Paul Frees, who did a lot of work for Disney, but also did a lot of dubbing. He was the voice of the Rings, you might remember, in The Time Machine. And his voice is very familiar. In fact, one of the first albums I ever bought was him singing 1960s songs in the voices of Humphrey Bogart and Peter Lorre and Boris Karloff and other horror movie actors who weren't around at the time. But the dubbing is problematic, and there's a little bit of the R's and the L's being transposed the way that a lot of people thought that Japanese people did. But I tried to put that aside and just enjoy the movie. I wasn't able to locate a copy of the Japanese version. But in the Japanese version, the bit with the ghost ship where some people on another freighter find a ghost ship and go on board and get attacked by the H-men, that came at the front of the film in the Japanese version. It's a very effective scene too. It really is wonderful. They film it with only the lighting that the guys bring with them, so there's no evidence of kind of studio lights or any of that kind of falsehood. And so they find all the empty clothing and they crack some jokes and think, oh, look, these guys stripped off their clothing. What the hell's going on here? And then the monster attacks. And the slime monsters in this movie are really effective. They use a whole bunch of different techniques to evince the monsters in this one, reversing the film and just like pouring the gelatinous stuff they made out across a set that's been tilted, so it looks like it's flowing against the pull of gravity. And they reverse that in some cases when it's retreating, but it's a really effective work. It works a lot better than the special effects do in The Blob, for that matter. And it gives us more of a sense of the monsters having their own volition, stalking down prey rather than mindlessly doing it. Because there is a form for the H-Men, which is kind of humanoid, it's green, glowing humanoid. They're radioactive as hell, as you expect from a monster that was created by an H-bomb test. But they do kind of form ghostly green humanoid shapes at times. Though there isn't too much evidence that they're intelligent. They seem to be kind of mindless predators in a lot of ways. And that humanoid shape, maybe just them mimicking human beings. But I don't think the movie kind of went into that as much as a modern movie would. With modern movies of this type, you've got to have the scientific person going, ah, that's the reason they're doing that. But you don't get any of this one. In fact, for much of the film, it plays like a police procedural, which is still kind of interesting. A lot of it was shot. There were a lot of location shoots, particularly the night scene at the start where the guy doing the narcotics deal disappears and is absorbed by the H-Men. That's really, really effective. And it kind of works. There's a heavy rain pouring. We only see what certain characters see. The movie doesn't show us the monsters till later on, which is kind of cool. And one of the things I found interesting, this is where technology meets old-fashioned movie viewing. One of the things I found with my new 55-inch TV, which I'm talking about a lot, I know, but I can freeze frame on the DVD and then use Google Translate. There's an augmented reality thing on Google Translate that'll let you hold it up to a foreign language, writing in a foreign language, sorry, and then it will give you a translation on your phone screen. So I did that in a couple of bits here. So I found out that the exchange of drugs at the start of the film took place outside a bank branch, because that's the sign that was in the background. And a couple of other little bits like that, but you'd take forever to do it for all of one of these movies. And every time any Japanese script came up, kind of stop pausing the film, getting your phone out, doing the augmented reality thing, running your finger across it to show the software where the writing is, and then watching it pop up the translation. I'm sure it's incredibly useful if and when I go to Japan, but it was just a little bit of fun that I had with the movie. I could see what some of the writing said. Now, there were English written subtitles on some of the signs on doors and things like that, but it was just that little bit of extra fun you can play with technology with movies. So keep that in mind if you ever really need to know what it says on any sign in a foreign script or a foreign language even. You can use your phone and the Google Translate software to more or less get the gist of what's showing up on the screen, which is fun. Use your technology in a fun way. Don't just see it as a drag or a burden. Anyway, you're listening to a podcast, so you're definitely au courant with technology and technological change. But that was just a little bit of extra I got from this one, and I thought, yeah, it's pretty cool. And eventually, I suppose, it's going to get to the stage where you'll be able to wear a pair of glasses while you're watching movies, and those translations will occur automatically, which is kind of going to make viewing movies a totally different experience, which is kind of cool, but we'll see where that technology goes in the future. But I enjoyed it in this instance. The characters are kind of interesting, but also kind of generic in a way. Particularly the lead actress isn't very strong. She was much better known for her dramatic roles, and her name's Yumi Shirakawa, who plays Chikako, a singer in a nightclub. And she has a couple of really good scenes where, although dubbed, she sings a couple of kind of torch songs in English in the nightclub where she works. And I really like that. I found out by reading one of the seminal works on the cinema of Ishiro Honda, Peter H. Brothers, Mushroom Clouds and Mushroom Men, that the songs were actually written by some anonymous person at the British Embassy, who wrote the songs, orchestrated them, obviously, and gave them to the movie. And nobody knows who this person is, whether it was a man or a woman, don't know. But they had an English language person from the British Embassy write the songs. They're not fantastic songs. They're not Cole Porter. They're not Hoagy Carmichael. They're not even Johnny Mercer. But they're not bad. They kind of work in context. And the nightclub scenes in this movie are incredible. Nightclub scenes in Japanese crime cinema in general are pretty fucking good, but these ones are really nice. There's a woman playing a saxophone in silhouette you see during one scene. Yeah, they concentrate a little bit on the musicians playing the loungy jazz music in the background. It's very, very cool, and it's part of the movie that really kind of lifts it and gives it an energy, even though the cops, particularly Akihiro Hirata playing Inspector Tominaga, and Police Sergeant Miyashita, played by Eitaro Ozawa, and I'm getting these names wrong, and I really apologize for it. It's kind of cool. I really like Japanese police procedurals and the hats. The kind of adoption of westernized dress and adoption of westernized ways, but with the Japanese tilt that we got in post-war Japan, is really interesting. I really enjoy that kind of stuff. You also see it to a much greater degree in the 1955 English language film House of Bamboo that Samuel Fuller directed. You see a lot of post-war Japan in that, and it's kind of cool. And it's fascinating to just see how soon after the war Japan hit the ground running as far as adoption of technologies and adoption of change and kind of using the culture of the people who dominated them but putting their own spin on it. And you get a lot of this in The H-Man. I think that there's a little bit too much focus in some ways, though, on the police procedural side of it and the characters and the criminals and the cops. There are a couple of nice moments there, particularly one where somebody's being shown criminals in a book of that have got all the criminals in it. The cops are showing them to try to see their reaction when they see certain faces in this book of criminal photos that the cops have. And the guy kind of reacts to one of the photos, and the cop looks down, and it's the photo of the guy sitting in front of him. So there are a couple of nice little moments like that that really do work. Eventually, the cops and the authorities in general realize that they do have a monster on their hands and start working on it. They find out fairly quickly that electricity and fire are the only answers to the age men, and that if they don't do something about it, the bugger's going to take over the earth. Japan first and then the rest of the planet, because they can travel through sewers very effectively. They can squeeze through cracks in windows and under doors. There's no stopping them apart from destroying them. And they set about doing that in a way that in some ways parallels the movie Them from the early 1950s, the American one, where they've got people going through sewers and attacking monsters. It's got very much that kind of feel. There are a lot of scenes that use a combination of model work and other special effects that kind of work really nicely. There's a scene with a Jeep going across a bridge over a river that's on fire, because they put petrol and things onto the river to try to kill the monsters. And even though that's model work, it is really effective. I'm surprised at how good the special effects are in this film. The monster is evoked really, really well. And even though we kind of realize how it's being done, the cleverness of it and the use of tilting sets and the choices made while doing those special effects, basically of dripping slime, really get us on board with it. Even though we recognize what it is, the cleverness does kind of give it a plus, to the point where I went, yeah, okay, cool, I like that. Even though it's totally comprehensible to me how the special effects people have done it, they've used it artistically and craftily and in a way that ramps up the tension. There is a scene with another nightclub dancer, in the movie where she's attacked by the monster, and that too is really effective. She's in her underwear and the monster basically drips itself up her leg, which is, male gazey kind of stuff. But nonetheless, it does work well. There are some scenes where the cops experiment on frogs to try to replicate the things that occurred to make the H-Men. And that's kind of effective too. I'm not sure whether any frogs were damaged during the making of this film, though I suspect they may well have been. But they got this frog that kind of bubbles up and turns into slime. And it reminded me of something else in a more recent film. Remember in the version of The Hulk that Ang Lee did, where Bruce Banner is experimenting on frogs in the lab at the start of the film and they kind of fizz up and pop and explode and things like that? I think that may be a direct reference and referencing of the H-Man, because the parallels there are pretty obvious, and the idea of having frogs bubble and pop is probably a direct reference there. And of course, Ang Lee, being familiar with Asian cinema as he would be, would know that. And that was kind of a nice little moment there for me, as the kind of person who makes these connections as a matter of course. But I'm going to have to rewatch more Honda, and I'm going through Mushroom Clouds and Mushroom Men to find the bit about the Age Man. And there are other movies I've got to track down there that have kind of slipped between the cracks for me, or I haven't seen for decades. And so I've got a feeling I may be going on to a kaiju, classic kaiju binge at some time in the near future. As I've said before, I have a little more spare time on my hands now, and I might as well use it watching the cinema of Ishiro Honda, who was the master of this kind of stuff. He really did. Yeah, this is kind of minor Honda in a lot of ways, and doesn't get a lot of love. I got it in a four-pack with a couple of other movies, including The 27th Day, the one with Gene Barry that I've mentioned on a previous podcast, and The Day the Sky Exploded, and one other thing, maybe Valley of the Dragons, which is a really bad early 1960s low-budget science fiction film. But I think this is the best of the four, to be honest with you. The H-Man really does work. It addresses all of those fears that Japan had about the aftermaths of nuclear weapons. And also, there's the Lucky Dragon incident in the 1950s, where a Japanese fishing boat drifted into a cloud of fallout after some Pacific nuclear tests, and all of those sailors were irradiated. And the movie references that with the boat piece that that occurs in the film. And that kind of recognition of the perils of nuclear power and nuclear testing, which, of course, was addressed 4 years before this in the original Godzilla, really comes to the fore. It was an ongoing obsession with certain parts of Japanese cinema. And they're the parts, of course, that we really know and love. I know maybe 5 or 10 people who are total kaiju nuts. And kaiju, of course, for those who don't know, being giant Japanese monsters. And they worship Honda in a lot of ways. He really was the Martin Scorsese of this kind of film. I do think there are a few pacing issues with it, which is, you know, fair to say, and has been recognized by Peter Brothers in his book. But overall, even kind of second-tier Ishiro Honda movies are much more interesting than a lot of stuff you're going to see. And if you can get a copy of The H-Man, definitely enjoy it. I'm going to find out, give me a moment, I'm going to find out whether there's a decent copy on YouTube, because I know not everyone can afford to buy every movie that I mentioned. But if you got the download, you can always check it out on YouTube. I'll just find out one way or the other. And guess what? No, it isn't on YouTube. But I'm sure you can find it. Hang on, wait a sec. No, you're going to have to find it somewhere else, because unfortunately it isn't on YouTube. There are a lot of weird and wonderful movies that are up there for some reason. But unfortunately, this one isn't one of them. So hunt it down. It's worth seeing, particularly if you're an Ishiro Honda completist. And I did enjoy it more than I expected to, and that's kind of surprising, because I'd heard kind of mediocre things about it. The next one I'm going to try is The Liquid Vapor, a movie he made 2 years later about a man who can turn himself into a gas. And that one is a little stronger. Maybe I'll even do it for a future podcast. Let me know if you'd like me to. So I'm going to take a break now and put on a pot of chili con carne for dinner. And when I get back, we are going to talk about the first of Amicus Productions portmanteau films, the 1965 Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, starring Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and Donald Sutherland, directed by the late, great Freddie Francis.
House of Horrors. Horrors the screen has never before dared to depict. The terrifying horror of man killing blind with a human brain that creeps and kills. The terrifying horror of the dead, entombed for 200 years, that creeps its way back to terrorize the living. The terrifying horror of a dreaded man called Dr. Terror, who, with his deck of mystic cards, could foretell destiny. Dr. Terror's House of Horrors.
Portmanteau films, which are also known as anthology films, have been around for a really long time. One of the first in the horror genre, the one that directly influenced Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, was the 1948 film Dead of Night, which I talked about on a previous podcast, as indeed I've talked about so many of them. They tended to be a post-war kind of thing in a lot of ways, though. There were a couple before the war. There was L'Amore, directed by Roberto Rossellini. Tales of Manhattan in 1942. Intolerance, even, in 1916, was an anthology film. And in 1968, we had The Illustrated Man, of course. There were some that were done as short story movies based on the short stories of Somerset Maugham, the first one of which was Quartet in 1948. So it came out in the same year as Dead of Night. There was another one in 1950 called Trio, which I haven't seen, but I've seen Quartet. And in 1951, there was one called Encore. And in 1952, there was an American anthology film called O. Henry's Full House, based on the stories of O. Henry. So the concept's not new. In 1965, when Milton Subotsky of Amicus Films decided to do a portmanteau horror film directly influenced by Dead of Night, he wanted to do one. In fact, he wanted to do it as a TV series in the late 40s and early 1950s. And some of the scripts for the episodes in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors were very much based on those scripts from his television attempt in the 50s. So in 1964, along with Max J. Rosenberg, Subotsky founded Amicus Productions. He's from a New York Jewish family. He did a number of Amicus productions after doing his first horror film in 1960 called Horror Hotel, which I've seen before. He actually, 1956, he produced Rock, 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 for which he composed 9 songs. I'm just looking up Rock, Rock, Rock now. It was that one with Alan Freed, Tuesday World, Chuck Berry, amongst other things. So Milton Subotsky wrote some of the songs. I'm just trying to find out which songs Subotsky wrote, but I can't seem to find which ones, which is kind of cool. He started out doing rock and roll films, did a horror film in 1960 called Horror Hotel, and then formed Amicus in 64. Amicus was always kind of a low-budget, horror-based, mostly portmanteau horror films, though there were in standalone ones like The Skull in 65, The Deadly Beast in 66, I, Monster in 71, Now the Screaming Starts, The Beast Must Die, which I've really got to do for a future one, and a really creepy little thriller called The Psychopath in 1966, which when I first saw it scared the fuck out of me. He also did the two Doctor Who-based movies, Doctor Who and the Daleks and Dalek Invasion Earth 2050 AD, and some crime films, a few other things. He actually did a film version of Harold Pinter's play, The Birthday Party, as well, directed by William Friedkin. So Amicus was a little broader than we first think when we think of that. The portmanteau films that Amicus did are always really interesting because you get some interesting actors in, get them work for a couple of days on this short episode of a portmanteau film, and they wander off and do other things that they like. The ones that I've got here in front of me are, of course, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors in 65, Torture Garden in 67, The House That Dripped Blood in 71, Tales from the Crypt 72, Asylum 1972 as well, Vault of Horror, 1973, and Beyond the Grave in 1974, which again was one that scared me. Beyond the Grave is really fucking freaky, basically. Yeah, but portmanteau films were kind of, I think, Subotsky's love in some ways, and this one has some really interesting actors in it. The frame story, which you may well know, is that 5 men get on a train with a 6th man, a guy called Dr. Shrek, played by Peter Cushing, with a beard and extra hair on his eyebrows and a hat. And they have a chat. There's an architect, played by Neil McCallum. I won't go through the actors. I'll go through the episodes of and how effective they were. But the five men all decide to have their fortunes told by Dr. Shrek, Shrek being German for terror. And he then tells the story of how they end up in very nasty circumstances. Some of the episodes are stronger than others. Some of them seem to be quite short for the story they need to tell, and there's not enough kind of background for us to really get engaged with the characters. Nonetheless, there are a couple that are very effective, and you know, I'd say they're running about maybe 40-50% effective, and the others very much show their television episode origins. So I'll just go through each of the stories and kind of give you a bit of an overview. The first one's called Werewolf, and it's about an architect called Jim Dawson, played by Neil McCallum, a character actor, Scottish character actor, who's returns to his old family home on a Scottish island to make renovations for the new owner, Mrs. Bidoff, played by Ursula Howells, who had a career on television and in film, at least, of playing posh upper-class ladies. Mrs. Bidoff explains she bought the house to help her recover from the death of her husband. Now, in the basement, they find a coffin for a Count Cosmo Valdemar behind a fake wall. Valdemar was the original owner of the house and was killed in a conflict with the Dawson family centuries ago. Local legends state that Valdemar would reclaim his former home and take revenge on the current owner. Dawson discovers that Valdemar is rising at night as a werewolf. So they kind of mix up the werewolf and the vampire mythology in this. Of course, there's a twist on it, and it doesn't end well for Jim Dawson, the architect. This is one of the ones that definitely portrays or betrays its origin as a TV script. There's a little bit of atmospheric stuff there, but it's very much TV level of horror. It's not going to scare anyone particularly. The twist is pretty obvious because we've seen it in a number of other Amicus productions, amongst other things, in the years since 1965. So for me, and because Neil McCallum isn't, it doesn't have a lot of presence as an actor, it kind of doesn't work. We don't invest in the character and his ultimate fate, and it's not too much of a giveaway to say that he does have an ultimate fate in this, isn't that much of a problem for us. So we get from there into the second one, which is called Creeping Vine, and it's about a guy called Bill Rogers, played by Alan Freeman, and his daughter and wife, played by Sarah Nichols and Ann Bell. They return from a vacation to discover that there's this weird, fast-growing vine in their garden. They find out that it's actually intelligent, and it's homicidal, and it's carnivorous. It kills their dog. They get people in to look at it, and things go crazy. So it's a kind of one-idea story, but it's not badly done. Now, Alan Freeman, who plays the main character in this, was known better as a DJ. He was actually Australian born, but he did his whole career up until his death around 2005, mostly as a DJ in the UK. He started out on the pirate radio ships back in the 60s and then developed a career as a DJ and was very well known and very well regarded. In his later life, he came out as being bisexual and he'd had a number of relationships with men in his life. He started out in 3KZ here in Melbourne in 1957, amongst others. He was on Pick of the Pops on BBC Radio and really had a large career and was known colloquially by his friends as Fluff. Now, there's an interesting kind of juxtaposition between Alan Freeman's life and his look, because he looks like an ex-rugby player. He's got a kind of broken nose, smashed-in mug kind of look about him, which shows that, you know, all sorts of people can be gay or straight or bi or anything like that, because he doesn't actually look like somebody who's a stereotype of a certain sexuality. But we do get a couple of cameos in this one, which are kind of interesting. The scientists who come and investigate this carnivorous vine. And the story is very crammed and it seems a bit too short for what it is. We don't get any character development for any of the characters, really. It's just like set up, action, conclusion. And the conclusion is kind of interesting. Well, I won't give that away, though. But the two people we get coming into this one are Bernard Lee, who played M in the James Bond movies for a lot of years, as Hopkins, one of the scientists. And the other one is Jeremy Kemp, who's an interesting character actor, really played villains a hell of a lot in movies. He was in the Blue Max film with George Papad, amongst other things. Let's see, he was in Four Weddings and a Funeral. He was in Top Secret, the Zucker Brothers movie. He was in A Prisoner of Zenda, The Ryman Exchange, Darling Lily, Pope Joan, all sorts of other things. So 7% Solution, he was the main villain in that, which is a nice Sherlock Holmes twist where Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud, played by Alan Arkin, Sherlock Holmes in this case being played by Nicole Williamson. So Jeremy Kemp comes in there, and you can tell that Bernard Lee and Jeremy Kemp in this one were basically coming in for a couple of days, doing a couple of days' work to earn a quid, and then getting out. And that was very much it for a lot of actors in the Amicus Portmanteau films. They just come in, do a couple of days' work, and then piss off. So from there we get into the third one, which is the one I like the least, to be really honest with you. And it's mostly because of the main actor in it. The episode is called Voodoo, and it's about a jazz musician called Biff Bailey, played by Roy Castle, who accepts a gig in the West Indies and sneaks off to see a local voodoo ceremony and then steals the melody of the music of the voodoo ceremony for a jazz composition that he has. It's a pretty short piece, and there's definitely a kind of one note, no pun intended, in this one. The thing on Wikipedia says that it was probably based on a short story called Papa Benjamin by the great writer, suspense writer, Cornell Woolrich, which had been adapted by the television series Thriller and the radio series Suspense in the past. Now, Roy Castle's the weak part in this one because it was his first major acting role. He got an OBE. In fact, he died in 1994, but he got an OBE. And he was prone to do pratfalls, and he was in actually Doctor Who and the Daleks with Peter Cushing, the Amicus TV movie adaptation of Doctor Who in 1965, same year this came out. But he was prone to do pratfalls and comedic stuff. He was very lightweight. He had a bit of a singing career as well, but in this one, his character is so unlikable that he really, you know, we don't really care about him. He plagiarizes the music. He treats everybody stupidly. He's not a lot of fun in the episode that he's in. The interesting person in this one, from a long-term point of view, is the black actor playing the black singer in this one. And it's a singer, songwriter, and entertainer and actor called Kenny Lynch, who's still alive. He's 79 years old. He's still alive. Now, Kenny Lynch, good singer, had a long career as an actor and as an entertainer in England. If you have a look on the band on the run cover for Wings, you'll see that there are two people from Dr. Terror's House of Horrors on the cover. One of them, of course, is Christopher Lee. But the black guy on the cover of Band on the Run, the one where all these guys are frozen in a spotlight, is Kenny Lynch. So we've got two actors from this movie who are on the Band on the Run cover by Wings. I'm not a big Paul McCartney fan, but it was just an extra little bit to throw in there. And he's much more engaging a character than Roy Castle's Biff Bailey. His character's a lot of fun, but you know, it's 1960s. They're not going to give the main horror, even anthology, the main horror role to an actor of colour, which was a mistake, but that they did stupid things like that at the time. Now, the next episode in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors is the big one, is the kind of Megilla, and that is Disembodied Hand. It's the one starring Christopher Lee, who plays a pompous art critic called Franklin Marsh, who's an egotist, and he disses art he doesn't like or understand. And there's a painter called Eric Lander, played by Michael Goff, who is the target of Franklin Marsh's ire. He gets humiliated and then does his revenge in a very interesting way on Franklin Marsh. Now, Marsh is pissed off as hell and decides to drive a car over Eric Lander, which he does, crushing Lander's hand, and he loses the hand. Lander soon commits suicide because he can't do art anymore. He's distraught. He's totally shattered by the fact that he can't paint anymore, so he shoots himself. Marsh then gets tortured by the disembodied hand of Eric Lander. And it doesn't matter what he does, he can't get rid of it. Now, there is a really nasty ending to this one. But the strength in the movie, in this particular movie, within a movie, is Christopher Lee playing against type. He's playing a nasty character. He gets to play shit scared a number of times as this disembodied hand keeps stalking him and trying to kill him. And it's not often you see Christopher Lee playing a weak character, but in this one you definitely do. The other good thing about it is the small time that we get with Michael Goff's character, Lander. He is really good in this. Now, Michael Goff was actually in the first Christopher Lee Dracula along with Christopher Lee, and I found his acting in that one pretty weak at the time. I think his character was very stagey and over the top and really kind of didn't work in any way at all. But playing Lander, he's great. He can justify his art. He can talk about his art. He has friends. He's popular. He's a very successful artist. But we get, in a very short period of time, that character arc of a successful person who's brought down by the nasty act of this art critic and crippled, and who then becomes distraught to the point of suicide. And Michael Goff does that really, really well. There is a bit of a problem with the disembodied hand. Some of the effects work on it is pretty good, but there are a couple of scenes where you can see the seams around the edge of the plastic hand or the latex rubber hand. In a more modern film, they would have got rid of the seams by sanding them down or removing them by chemical means. But in this one, you see the seams around the edge of the hand, and that kind of takes away from it a little bit. But it's not a bad little prosthesis with a little mechanical thing to make the fingers move and propel the hand along. There are a couple of bits where it's actually somebody's hand, but for the most part, it's a mechanical device. But yeah, forgive it that. It is of its time, and we're seeing this as well on the really. I saw this as well, really, on the nice Olive Films Blu-ray of it, and that high definition stuff kind of brings out those flaws, like that seam line, a little more than seeing it on a movie screen in a smoky cinema in 1965. So, yeah, you give yourself some points for that. But I like Christopher Lee in this. He's really effective. Michael Goff is surprisingly effective given the previous things I've seen him in. He was an actor who tended to overact. People most remember him for playing Alfred in the Tim Burton Batman movies much later in his career. But in this one, he really does nail it, and it's really good. The last one's a little episode called Vampire, with Donald Sutherland playing a doctor who returns to his home in the United States with a new French bride, and soon he finds evidence that a vampire is on the loose. And he seeks the aid of another doctor, Dr. Blake, played by Max Adrian. And they find out that Nicole is the vampire, and things progress from there. Max Adrian had a really long career. He's actually Northern Irish, even though he tended to sound Eastern European and other things. He was in the old Vic Company. He worked with John Gielgud. He had a tremendously long career on stage, mostly doing Shakespeare and classic works. But he did do some TV stuff, and he did some movies. He was in a really bad movie from 1967 called The Terranauts, which was, again, an Amicus production. He was in The Devils with Ken Russell's movie. He was in The Boyfriend, which is another Ken Russell movie. But he's also in Henry V, the Henry V with Larry Olivier and Leslie Banks. So he had a role in that, again showing that, who did he play in this? Let me have a look at this. Going down through it, and there's so many famous. Max Adrian played the Dauphin, the King of France at the time. So, yeah, that's kind of interesting. Somebody whose career goes from playing Shakespeare with Olivier to playing a small role in an Amicus film. It shows how roller coastery an actor's career could be at the time, and in fact is still to this day. But Max Adrian kind of plays it up because it's basically a comic little piece, even though Donald Sutherland plays it very seriously. In a sense, because of the upshot at the end of the film, he's playing straight man to Max Adrian's character. And it's kind of jokey in a sense. It really doesn't work as well. But it is showing us right at the start of the career of Donald Sutherland, because he hadn't done many film roles before this one. And let me just see whether he had done any film roles before this. Let's have a look. Blah, blah, blah. He was actually in the London Academy of Music and Drama Arts early in his career. He did some TV. He did Castle of the Living Dead with Christopher Lee in 1964, and then Dr. Terror's House of Horror. So it's probably around his second film role. But I just finished talking a little while ago on Paleo Cinema Podcast about MASH with Donald Sutherland in it. And the Donald Sutherland we see in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors and the Donald Sutherland we see in movies like MASH and Kelly's Heroes, you can definitely see him getting more comfortable in front of the camera and being more himself in front of the camera. But in this one, because he's got that kind of gawky, slightly wall-eyed look about him, he, again, it's one of those things where the character that he gives us in this one isn't particularly sympathetic. He's very much in love with his wife, Nicole. The interesting thing there is, of course, that Jennifer Jane played Nicole, playing a French woman, and she was born in Yorkshire and did mostly stage work, but a number of smaller roles on film. But it kind of really does work. The standout piece in this one, of course, is the Christopher Lee severed hand episode. But again, with these portmanteau films, if a couple of them don't work, wait 5 minutes, another episode starts, and you've got another chance to be entertained. And then, of course, there's the upshot at the end on who Dr. Terror actually is, and what the ultimate fate of the characters is, and which again leads to some problems, because we see the fates that the people in each episode have, but it's not the same as the ultimate fate they have in the movie. They have a different fate. So the question then becomes, and this is a giveaway, so if you don't want spoilers, go away for a minute. Because Dr. Terror is the devil. Basically, the stories the devil tells on the train are the devil taking the piss out of these people and just basically mocking these guys who died in a train accident. So you see there's an extra level there to the character that Peter Cushing plays quite malevolently in this film. The stories he tells and the horrors that he tells the people they're going to experience were just him fucking with them, basically. And their ultimate fate was to die in the train crash. So that's kind of cool. And I'm sure that at least at some level it was the intention of the filmmakers to have that extra level there. But I remember when I was very young going to the movies, one of the movies I desperately wanted to see was Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. And I didn't get to see it until VHS days, a decade or two later. But the poster for it, and I think I may have seen the trailer as well when I was at the cinema, led me to want to see the movie, because it was at its time. And you've got to remember that we've desensitized to horror to such a great degree these days, both by the things we see on television and streaming media, and by the graphicness of movies, that we lose the sense of how horrifying these things actually were to people at the time they came out. And this one definitely was. Particularly the Christopher Lee episode would have scared the shit out of people in cinemas. And you've also got that kind of group thing where a bunch of people get together to watch a horror movie. It's very much, at least from an emotional level, a lot different in experience than watching it at home, even if you do have a home theater. you get that kind of, you know, there are hormones and pheromones and scents, and if one person gets jumpy and screams suddenly, you're agitated by the fact that they scream suddenly, and if people are shuffling around and getting nervous watching a horror bit in a film, seeing things in the cinema does give you that kind of group emotional gestalt, which then increases and enhances the horror of any particular movie of horror that you're watching. Or in another case, if everybody is bored to fuck by a Michael Bay film, then you'll be bored to fuck too. But yeah, I really enjoyed revisiting Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. It is fun, and just kind of passing out what worked and what didn't work was a bit of enjoyment this time around. It really was cool to do that. And having the Blu-ray, the sharpness of the image, it's as sharp as I've ever seen it, because previously I think I saw it on VHS. And having this lovely Blu-ray version of it really gave me a good experience with it. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. I still haven't fixed up the credits. I apologize for that. I'm slacking off. I've suddenly gone into a torpor in the 6 weeks since I left work, and I'm not doing more than I actually have to on any given thing. And I've talked to Sal about that, and we're working out a way for me to structure my weeks so that I'll probably be recording the podcasts, not on the weekends in future, but during the weeks. And I want to get one or two ahead, because I can actually do that now. My time constraints are mostly lifted. And so what I intend to do, and again, this is an intention, not a promise, is get a few episodes under my belt and have them ready, so that if I do want to wander away, and in fact, in November, Sally and I are going to Tasmania for a couple of weeks. We're going to take take the car across on the ferry and have a good time over there, and probably buy movies, you know how it goes. But yeah, so I do want to get ahead, and I do want to fix up a few things. So the credits are still there. The two Careys, of course, are always valued as Patreon subscribers of the podcast. In fact, one of the people I'm going to be seeing in Tasmania is one of the two Careys who are Patreon supporters. And I'll probably bring him a present for being a Patreon supporter, and also for being a friend of mine for more than 30 years. Nonetheless, thank you for listening. Thank you for enjoying the movies that you enjoy. And I occasionally get some feedback via Facebook. People like Chris Mounts give me some good feedback. He usually posts up what podcast he's listening to on his Facebook. And occasionally one of my paltry little efforts turns up there, which is kind of nice. And yeah, and just kind of enjoy yourselves. Watch some good movies, watch some bad movies. I'm looking forward to Thor Ragnarok coming up in November, which is kind of not quite imminent, but is going to be out soon. There'll be a few other things coming up in the next few months. Right at this moment, it's a bit of a fallow period. It's when all the horror movies come out, and I can see those later on streaming services. But I'm not particularly interested in seeing them now. The other thing I've watched lately, and I used up a bit of time watching, is season 3 of BoJack Horseman, which is the best comedy drama on television, even though it is in an anthropomorphic cartoon universe. So anyway, look after yourselves. Watch good movies, watch bad movies. Keep watching the skies. Take care of yourselves and the people around you, and I'll be back very soon. And here, of course, are the credits in the style of movie credits. I may even slip in a bit of music at the end of it, so stick around for that. Thanks again. See you later.
Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our Technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Kerry, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.
Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on pumping, make the butter flow. Wipe off the paddle and churn some more. Little boy blue, come blow your horn. Cows in the meadow, the sheep's in the corn. Take the sheep, leave them be. Bring the finest brown cows straight to me. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on pumping, make the butter flow. Wipe off the paddle and churn some more. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on pumping, make the butter flow. Wipe off the paddle and churn some more. Brown cow, keep on eating hay. Go in your shed, be sure you're fed. Go in your shed, be sure you're fed. Daddy needs butter for his shortening bread. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on churning till the butter comes. Keep on pumping, make the butter flow. Wipe off the paddle and churn some more. Make the butter flow. Wipe off the barrel and churn some more. I wanted some butter one day. Found brown cow came my way. We kept on pumping. Butter came jumping. I'll milk you cow till my pail is full. Look out, Heifer. Here comes your bull.